Okay, folks, we might get going. I know it's probably been a long, hot day, and you guys have probably been at a lot of sessions. We've just rushed across the town from Brunswick, trying to beat peak hour traffic and find a park, and here we are, and we're really pleased to be here, and thanks for coming. My name's John Staley, and I'm going to be talking about a project called YouthWorks Media, which has really just started up this year. Okay, I'm going to give a little bit of background on YouthWorks, the project, and the partnerships that have made it happen. Then I'm going to be followed by a picture of some of the young people we work with, the methodology we employ in relation to this, and finally some visual and auditory examples of some of the work we're doing. So this is going to be my part's going to be a bit of a show and tell, really. I'm going to hand over to Georgia Webster from Sin Media, and followed by Annetta Podkalicka from Swinburne University, who will be discussing the research element to this project. This project, YouthWorks, has been around conceptually for a number of years and was part of the original proposal that was successful in Sin, which is the Sin radio station, being granted a full metropolitan broadcasting licence in, what year was it, 2000? 2003. Okay, so the idea for YouthWorks has been around for a long time, but the kind of the earthing of it hasn't happened till quite recently. While Sin rapidly went on to grow and flourish and successfully fulfil its role as a community student-run radio broadcaster and now broad media provider, YouthWorks, the project in its fullness, never quite hit the ground or the airwaves. That is until the end of last year, when a physical space was leased in Brunswick out of which to run the project, and all the original partnerships and one or two new ones clicked into sync, so to speak. So what is YouthWorks, or YouthWorks Media as we are now calling it? At the heart of YouthWorks is the idea of providing creative real-world media experience and training for young people who are at significant risk. In short, giving disadvantaged young people access to radio training and broadcasting within a genuine functioning media outlet, such as Sin. Which, for those people familiar with Sin, by the way, just put your hand up if you are familiar with Sin. Okay, so a few of you. So Sin is basically a student-run radio station that... It's youth-run. Sorry, Georgia. And Georgia's going to give a broader picture of Sin later, so she'll fill in the gaps. Okay, so the basic concept, like I said, giving disadvantaged young people access to radio training and broadcasting within the confines of Sin. A simple concept, but one that requires a very particular infrastructure and a particular set of relationships and partnerships to work effectively. Indeed, in many respects, it's the partnerships that really define this project. So what are the partnerships in a nutshell? YouthWorks is administered by Youth Development Australia, a not-for-profit youth agency, with initial seed funding from the Salvation Army Crossroads Youth Services. It works in direct physical and geographic partnership with Brunswick Youth Services, a specialist youth agency that's also part of the Salvation Army. Then, of course, there's Sin. So in a way, we have Sin and Salvation, which have been there since perhaps the beginning of time, and it was always thus. You can't have one without the other, I suppose. Of course, I'm taking liberties, but it's hard to resist. As Oscar Wilde said, I can resist everything but temptation, and that was too hard for me. Okay, to round off the partnerships, there's also NMIT TAFE, who will act as an RTO for some accredited training we're going to be doing in the next year or so. And finally, we have Swinburne University, Institute of... So we've got all these up here. Swinburne University Institute of Social Research and the Centre for Creative Industries and Innovation, who provide research expertise and will track the history, development and outcomes of this project over the next 3 to 5 years. Whew, so that's a lot of partners. And it's quite a unique set of relationships. And where do I particularly fit into this relationship? Why am I up here speaking to you, I suppose? As it turns out, I'm employed by three of those partners. So every now and then I have a meeting to do strategic planning with myself, and then I talk to a couple of others, and we have a lot of fun. I'm employed by Youth Development Australia to run the project 2 days a week. I'm also employed by NMIT as a teacher. I'm in a related program that works with kids who are at risk of homelessness. And I also am doing a practical film-based PhD with Swinburne. Okay, so under the one roof, I'm pretty much doing three roles, as I said. What background has equipped me, or hasn't equipped me, if the case may be? I hope it's equipped me, I think it has. What background's equipped me for these roles, and how does this relate to at-risk youth? For 10 years prior to this role, and now concurrent with it, I've worked predominantly with, I guess, with people on the margins. People whom, for social, cultural and geographic reasons, do not easily sit within the story of Middle Australia, the story that dominates our cultural landscape. And I use the word story here really deliberately, because I believe the shape, the taste and the feel of stories we tell ourselves and are told about ourselves are a critical part of what we come to believe is possible. And I'll return to that theme in a moment, as I really think that's really relevant working with at-risk people. I think it's relevant in life across the board, but particularly in this domain. So over the past decade, I've worked with Indigenous and non-Indigenous students at Northland Secondary College. It's an interesting school in Preston with a very interesting history. Was closed down for a number of years and then reopened in the Kennett government days. It was closed down. There was a Koori community that fought the closure and eventually had the school reopen. I worked there for a number of years. I've worked with Indigenous prisoners at Barwon Prison, disengaged and engaged young people in many youth programs through NMIT, doing VCAL programs. And I'm currently co-teaching the NMIT program I mentioned, and as well as overseeing the development of YouthWorks. So what this means is I've spent a good deal of time reflecting on what it actually means to be disengaged or at risk. A lot of times driving home in peak hour traffic down the Eastern Freeway going, what the fuck happened today? And how can I learn from that? Because often when you're faced with kids in a classroom situation and the volatility of their lives, you have to think on your feet a lot of the time, but you need an underpinning philosophy to understand how to work with these kids. So in general sense, what are the risks? When we say at risk, what does that mean? The young people we work with are either homeless, in the sense that they're in some sort of residential or foster care, or they've become disengaged from mainstream education. Quite often they've been expelled or spent significant chunks of time simply not attending any formal education program, often for years. So in a general sense, many of the kids we work with have very low levels of literacy and quite often have drug or alcohol issues. So in a sense, I guess they're at risk of not being able to share in the economic prosperity and job security most of us aspire to, and don't necessarily have the skills or the desire to access a conventional work or study path, or don't yet have the skills. And this is where I return to the theme of story, for I believe in many respects our circumstances are partly shaped by the narrative and geographic circumstances we find ourselves in. I think if you grow up, even the suburb that you grow up in, partly defines the culture you believe or what you come to believe about yourself. I think the experience of growing up in Broadmeadows and what that means for a kid is going to be very different from the experience of growing up in South Yarra. For instance, I'm using two extremes there. But what the world says about what's possible for you and what you say about what's possible for yourself can often be defined by geography and these sort of things. A lot of the kids we work with are from those regions, from Broadmeadows, for instance. So, this is where I return to the theme of story, for I believe that it's really, really critical. If you've never sat down at a breakfast table and witnessed members of your family prepare for a day of work or study or go into the world to do things they love, I imagine it's much harder for that narrative possibility to enter into your own life or to imagine that. In my mind, it's one of the greatest risks a person faces, any person, not being able to see a coherent, tangible future where there's a sense of possibility or a sense of choice. There's a character in a film. I used to work with an Indigenous filmmaker for a number of years called Richard Franklin, who's quite a crazy, wild man when I think about it, but has done some amazing work all over the place and, you know, written films and plays and a range of other things. One of his films is called No Way to Forget, and there's a character in it, a young boy, and he says, at one point in the film, he says, "Oh, Uncle. Uncle, when I woke up and realised where I was, I looked to my future and seen me getting drunk again, getting stoned again, hurting people again, hating again and getting locked up again. And this was why, Uncle, that's why I wanted to die, because when I looked to my future, I had none." From No Way to Forget. Richard has a saying that he uses often, and when we used to work together, he had this saying which goes, "When you have art, you have voice. When you have voice, you have freedom. And with freedom comes responsibility." And that's a philosophy I very strongly believe in, and one that certainly underpinned a lot of the work that we did. But the idea that through the arts, sometimes people who don't necessarily have a voice in other domains can start to find a voice and start to experience a level of freedom that you might not necessarily experience in other parts of your life, but hopefully that can then flow over and build. So all of us, I believe, wherever we come from, wish to find some level of belonging, some sense of sustaining our identity. And if we aren't given the tools to find it in a constructive, creative, healthy way, we'll tend to look for it in an oppositional or destructive manner. In that, I'm reminded of a quote that my father in his... He's got a very, very deep voice, my father. And when we grew up, he used to read... He was right into poetry. I don't know how it helped me, but he used to quote a lot of poetry on Sunday afternoons. Anyway, he used to give us this this little saying from a book with a great title called Advice from an Old Mistress to a Young Wife. So I actually read this book recently. It's a terrible book. But I thought the title was great, and it's got this one great line in it, which goes, "That lonely cry in all of us not to be nothing, to make our mark upon the universe, to matter." From my reading of it, that lonely cry often manifests itself upon brick walls in urban streets or the inside of train carriages in the form of graffiti tags or images. That lonely cry sometimes manifests itself in the temptation and short-lived ecstasy of drugs. That lonely cry can lead to a person finding refuge in a roaming gang, whereas a student said to me last year, you can make one phone call and have 100 mates rock up and to beat the shit out of someone, which is awful to think that that's a form of protection that you call on. That lonely cry that sees 15-year-old girls with very little formal education or job prospects find direction and purpose through getting pregnant. So how do we here as a society, or how do we and how do we in this project respond to that? How do we seek to address these issues of future and narrative possibility? Firstly, I don't think there's any quick and easy fix for any of this sort of stuff that I'm talking about. No simple solution that can transform the patterns and geography built up over a lifetime. The way we approach this project is we try and approach it from the top of the creative spectrum. So we believe that sometimes it's not just the survival stuff that's the most important. It's sometimes about the creative stuff as well, and that we need survival skills, but we also need to tap into people's creative kind of spirit, if you like, to engage them, get them on board, and build the desire, hopefully, to then also build up the survival skills underneath that. So how do we do this? The concept of youth work, as I said, is built on the idea of creative real-world media engagement within a supported context. And I can't emphasise how critical that supported context is. On the ground, we've got a relationship with Brunswick Youth Services through the Salvation Army, and that support, both in the geography we work opposite and also in the support that we have from the Salvation Army, the youth workers and so on, is absolutely critical to the success of this project. They provide a whole range of care for the kids that allows them to get in the door and get into our project support with housing, support with transport, support with food, a whole range of things. But ultimately, it's about trying to get them engaged in an education program, get them building up their skills. We've also got, obviously, a great relationship we're establishing with SIN. And the opportunity that provides for our young people to go live to air. We have a radio show once a week that goes live to air to a broad metropolitan audience of other young people. So we're lucky to have a great culture that's already established at SIN that we can draw on, that allows space for creative expression, peer-to-peer training and informal mentoring, and a culture of innovative use of media technology. Indeed, what's the experience for some of our kids when they go off to the radio? They started our studio in Brunswick, which we've been building up. I'm going to show you a couple of images of that in a minute. They go there and then they go into radio in Carlton at SIN, so they've got to travel a bit and come into the city. And the excitement of some of the kids when they've come out of the studio is unbelievable. It is fantastic. They get peppered with text messages and from friends and family, and they're walking at least a foot off the ground some of the time. And in fact, one of our kids, Haka, when he was asked... what it was like by Anetta, who's a researcher, what it was like to go live to air the first time, he said, "I felt like my balls dropped 10 times, which I thought was great because I was happy when mine dropped once. So anyway, that says to me that for him that was a heightened experience, and that was an important experience. And if we think of heightened experiences for young people, we hope that they're positive. There's the positive ones as well, because there's a lot of heightened experiences that involve other forms of height, whether it's through drugs or through stealing or through other things that we seek to find a heightened experience. Hopefully we can find some heightened experiences that are creative and constructive and still very authentic. Okay. sorry, Netta, I stole it. Okay. So in practical terms, what do we actually offer? I've talked a lot of sort of philosophy and lonely cries and quotes and all of that sort of stuff, but what do we actually do? We run, at the moment, we've set up, as I said, this year, and we're running a program we call Open Access, where we have groups, targeted groups, come in and they run, do mini shows in our studio, and then they're supported to go, like I said, live to air at Sin. We've also been starting to take on filmmaking, and we've also, so again, we can run, you know, half day or full day workshops around filmmaking, creating digital storytelling, and also independent project support. So kids who have shown an interest in media, we've at this stage been trying to support them to come in, use the studio, use the space in whatever flexible way we can. We've had a couple of kids, a kid called, a young boy, who in recent weeks has been writing a rap song for the first time. He's been out of, been juvenile justice kid, been out of education for 18 months, 2 years, and has come in once a week and spent an hour in the studio, and we've been writing a song together, and he's which we've actually ended up putting on as part of a CD of three songs. And that's about his experiences, but with a bit of articulation and support around that. Okay. Next year, we're going to also, with NMIT, TAFE, we're going to be running a Certificate 2 in Creative Industries and Media, half of the time, so a 15-hour course, and the rest of the time we'll continue to run our open access, and that's been a really strong philosophical point, is that to make sure that we keep time for open access and we make sure that we can always, we don't lock the studio down just in accredited learning, because there's a lot of kids who just need a one-off experience, or they need to come in a couple of times, or they need to just get one opportunity to go live, you know, come in, do some training, go off to Sin, and that's enough at this stage. It would be, but that's a valuable experience, and that may be the seed that sows something else down the track. Okay. So in terms of sort of concluding my main talking part of this, and then I'm going to do a bit of showing and then hand over to the others, I guess my hope and dream with this is that the number of the young people who engage with us and Sin and the other partnerships over the next few years are stimulated to re-engage with education in a more general sense and develop through that a greater sense of confidence and skills and a greater sense of narrative purpose, returning to the theme of story. That's my hope and dream. Some will end up with paid work in media, which is tough at the best of times. I think we'll get there with some kids. I hope so. Now, our challenge as an organisation will be to harness the enormous energy that these young kids have, because they do. They have enormous energy, sometimes enormous lethargy too, like all of us, who are already engaging with the project, but help them give them their own legs so that we're not a destination but an opening. Help them to build their own authentic story. I'm just going to look at now a couple of examples, just to give you a bit of a picture, some of the video and audio of some of the things we've been doing. So first I'm just going to track to a minute of just some radio voices, and then we'll go on to the next one. Okay, so have I got the right PC? So this is all a bit confusing down here, but we'll get there. Got it. Beautiful. So there's no vision on this one. This is just sound like you experience on the radio.
This is beautiful and it's free. Hey, my name's Corey, a.k.a. Wolfman. We're the kids from BYS. You're listening to Sin, that's 90.7 FM. On the show today, we will be talking about graffiti, global warming, and cab drivers that get bashed.
Right, cab drivers get bashed.
You're listening to Music of Works Media on sin.org.au. We're here today to give you an insight on mainstream and alternative schooling and how young people feel about them. In other words, food come this year.
It's Sarah and Diane here, and we'll be talking about relationship issues. We've just received an email from Josie. She's got a question for us. I've been with my boyfriend for 4 years. I'm starting to not feel the same way anymore about him, and he's told me he hasn't been happy yet. What can I do?
This is Anthony
and Hunter. We're talking to you right about global warming. The problem with the world is the air pollution. In terms of pollution, It's cars, trucks, factories, motors, and diesel trains.
That's Haka with the deep voice.
Hi, my name is Marciana. I'm here with the girls, Alicia, Stacey, and Bridget. And we're going to talk about the difference between guys and girls getting with people.
This is Beautiful Earth Radio.
Okay, so that should return to our menu, presumably. So, yeah, that's just an example, obviously, just to give you a bit of a feel of some of the kids that are engaging with it. Next, I'm just going to show you, this is just a minute that shows you the physical sort of space and gives you a sense for it. And the startup, like I said, this has been just physically, we've actually refurbished a studio this year, and the studio is very much part of the heart of this project. It's a great space, but it's come at a lot of physical work for myself and Craig, who's sitting down here, and Annetta, the researcher, and a number of other people. But this is just some photos of starting it up. And in the background is a rap song that some of the kids just... You know, when you leave them in the studio and lock the door for an hour or so, they seem to come out with this stuff. So, we'll see what happens. Come on. Whip. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to make that small.
Then came back and rapping on the drug trap. Do it right here now with my low hat. Can't paint everyone to tell a picture. Boy, it's written on my tongue, my brother's making a scripture. Yeah, call me telling cause you know I'm always on point. From the time we get hit it out,
take it to the point.
Yeah, so do the smokers, tell me who's the lovers. I'll still have a spirit of love, praying in the notice. Get right here, this is the jockey. Yakos in the trunk, cause none of you just stop me. Yeah, I'm living dying. Lyrically, I cause damage. When I've got the mic, none of you can fucking manage. Without being clogged, jumped a few times, but I'm no stranger to spitting dangerous line.
Aussie, Aussie hip hop!
A bunch of kids recording the crew.
Aussie, Aussie hip hop!
Okay, so the last image you saw there was actually at Sin. So that studio space that we have in Brunswick is a really important space, a supported environment to work with the kids, but it's really also important for us, as I said, that's not the ultimate destination, that this project is about giving a supported context and a media context to engage, but it's ultimately it's about engaging with the broader world and giving skills that can support that. Time-wise, how are we going? Yep, we're going to... Okay, I'll show one or two other little quick things. We also, like I said, have been doing a bit of film stuff, but this will just show a little bit of a flavour of the some of the kids. These are like digital monologues, I suppose, or digital storytelling. I've just got full screen, so we'll go to scene selection, and we'll just run through two or three of these. They're very short. Okay.
My name is Anthony, I'm 17, turning 18 from December. My hobbies are school and playing guitar in my spare time. I've been playing guitar for about 12 months and I found it quite easy to play. I had my dad teach me the right scales, rhythm and strum patterns just to get me on my way. I was even lucky enough to play in a band for a couple of months, but I didn't really like their music, so I played it anyway. When I started playing, I got used to the pressure of playing with no mistakes. So I got offered to play at another place where the music was nice, but it was old and nice, and it was songs that I couldn't relate to. The style I like playing is soft rock, heavy metal, rock and roll, and rhythm and blues. My dream is to have a five-piece rock and roll band, or FM band.
Okay, I'm going to pause there. Folks, I'm going to wrap up my part of the talk because I'm just looking at the time, and I'd be really keen for Georgia and Annetta to come up and share a bit of their perspective on this project. So I'm going to now introduce Georgia Webster from SIN. Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks, John. I'll give you guys a little bit of a background on SIN, and I don't want to take too much of your time. Just wanted to come here today and let you know why the YouthWorks project has been so important for SIN and the outcomes we've had in a relatively short time. What has it been?
Yeah.
4 months or something?
Yeah,
since it's actually
about
6 months
that we've been up and running, but yeah.
Yeah. So SIN, for those who aren't aware, is a, call ourselves a youth community media organisation, so it's a lot of words to try and sum up what we do, but SIN began as a youth community station, radio station. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Good. I was supposed to give you this.
Oh, gosh.
It's podcasting. Sorry, folks. It's just...
Okay. There we are. So in 03 we started broadcasting on 90.7, a fairly traditional, you know, metro-wide radio licence, which is very valuable, and we're very, very glad to have that. And then if you put a bunch of kids in a room and say you can make radio, then they're excited about that, but then suddenly all they do is want to make TV as well. So we now do... we now have two programs on Channel 31. We have got the breakfast slot and also the drive slot for a music program. So if anyone's hasn't got a digital set-top box yet, you'll still get Channel 31 at home, and SIN does 10 hours a week of live broadcasting there. And also moving into the online realm at sin.org.au, you've got a new website. It's on its way. Bit of a nightmare web projects for anyone who's undertaken those in the past couple of years. But that's we really recognise that as the as a really integral and distinct third platform for us. So we're working hard at that. But where YouthWorks fits in for us is to do their underpinning philosophies and the reason for SIN's existence, which is to offer young people a platform, or in our case 2.5, 3 platforms, for expression, and have it be about them and have them be real young people and have very few barriers to their participation. So real focuses of SIN are participation, training and education. We've got some really comprehensive programs that for individual young people who might come to us wanting to get involved and hop on the radio or TV, and also stuff that goes through schools and formal community groups. So YouthWorks is an example of that, except that this is the first time that we've done it as a big sort of concerted partnership and had that the real proper flow through from the sort of agency level right through to YouthWorks, right through to coming on here with SIN. And for broadly speaking, it's been just an amazing experience for SIN to have that going on. One of our philosophies and programming aims at SIN is to have as diverse a huge range of young people on board, just having that opportunity. So for anyone who's ever tuned in, the only programming consistency that we've got on our radio is inconsistency. We change our programs every 3 months. It's this ingrained culture of refreshment and opportunity. So new people on board all the time, training them up all the time. We put probably about 40 kids a month through our radio training. So you can do the maths, it's quite a lot of young people come through, of which probably 20% will go on to do their own show, which is fantastic. Of course, when you've got these systems in place and these opportunities, there are, of course, a contingent of young people in the community who can't do that for themselves, whatever barriers, but John spoke of some barriers there. So we've got our school programs in place, and that's great because teachers facilitate those young people who are within those sort of mainstream systems. But the gap was always, and it was foreseen back when we got, John mentioned, back when the licence application processes were happening, it was foreseen that this was always going to be an issue, that SIN was always going to have problems really supporting and engaging at-risk young people, which that was before my time at SIN. But it's just that value and that has always been placed on those young people. So it's fantastic to have YouthWorks happening this year and really hearing them. For us, it's a fairly no fuss procedure. We've had there was a period in the sort of startup of YouthWorks where a guy, David, a young guy who's been a long-term volunteer with us, behind the scenes these days. We've lost him to SBS, which is sad, but he loves his soccer, so he's playing with them over there. But he was a great sort of central point, wasn't he, John? He acted as the trainer for the first contingents of young people that came through YouthWorks. So he was sort of, and we have a real, we call it our peer-to-peer learning model at SIN, which is effectively just having one other young person who's done it tell another group how to do it. And a few of us management types making sure the broadcast laws get inserted in there somewhere for risk management. But David was fantastic. He really got to know those first groups of young people and was the one bringing them in. And now we've got a system where we've got casual trainers at SIN that work with schools. And a great outcome of the YouthWorks partnership has been that John and Georgia, the other worker at YouthWorks, have offered our trainers, who are young people between about 18 and 24, offered them professional development in interacting and dealing with at-risk young people and understanding their perspectives. And I was talking to Anetta before about how some of those trainers actually come to me with personal reflections on how much their eyes have been opened by having the experience of working with the YouthWorks young people. So that's just a fantastic sort of side outcome, I think. For us, John mentioned the partnerships aspect, just to have a solid set of partnerships allows a cash-strapped community organisation like us and to tap into these perspectives and ideas and expressions of the young people that we might not be able to support ourselves. So it's been fantastic. Really looking forward to continuing and hopefully being involved with some of the accredited stuff that goes on. And the studio is just beautiful. If anyone did the bus tour yesterday, we're incredibly jealous of the studio. And proud of it, I guess, too, because it was built by ex-SIN volunteers who are now technicians in their own right. So, yeah, all in all, a really fantastic program and really in its infancy. So for SIN, it's really promising and we're looking forward to the future with it.
Hi, everyone. I've made a deliberate decision to be at the end because after such engaging presentations, I'm going to talk about research component. There is a very significant research component attached to the project, and I argue it's quite critical on top of course, all the creative activities that happen both at the Brunswick studio and at SIN. I've been in the role of research fellow for last 4 months, so I'm not going to present any of our findings or kind of my observations, but I want to kind of tell you why we researched this project in first place and what's important about the kind of evaluation of it. Still, I want to draw attention and reinforce the significance of the collaboration that we have. This potentially makes the project quite distinct. It's the kind of financial support that we're getting from the Salvation Army. Craig is a representative of the Salvos. They put money into the operation of the project while CCI funds the research component. So even in terms of kind of financial basis, this is quite kind of diverse, and as you heard, SIN provides kind of in-kind support. It is also very interesting from the research perspective, the very collaboration, because you might ask why this kind of new model of governance, of the kind of collaborative network emerged at this particular time in Australia. What does it tell us about kind of social management, I guess, at the moment? So this is very much the area that I'm keen to explore as a sort of researcher attached to the project. So why do we research it at all? In fact, like the whole kind of community-based arts media, whether it's digital storytelling or kind of, you know, community radio, it's not that sort of new at all. It's not a revolutionary project in itself. I guess also it taps really well into the whole kind of rhetorics of creative industries using creativity and media for, you know, social change. That's not really new. Like, perhaps the fact that we've got, you know, charity organization, and then we've got some social consultancy organization as well, which is YDS. It's not here. Oh, yeah, it is Youth Development Australia. And then we've got sort of real-world organization with real-world kind of audiences. It's quite significant as well, as in contrast to other sort of community-based projects. We provide those kids with an environment that potentially models the kind of real-world experience, kind of media experience. So that possibly is quite distinctive about our project. But what I argue is that those projects haven't really produced much kind of empirical data, what it actually means for how does this creativity works and what does it mean for the lives of those kids? How does it affect their lives, not only in terms of kind of tangible outcomes, the sort of employment-based outcomes, what John was saying, we don't know whether those kids actually are going to end up working in the creative industry sector, but how do we, from the research perspective, how do we capture this change, this creativity working on their personal, individual lives that kind of maybe refers back to your kind of narrative, the kind of individual narrative? So the research is obviously also closely linked up to the whole notion of, you know, funding, justifying funding and allocating resources in an accountable manner. As a researcher, I find it quite important to think through the methodology of capturing the social kind of impacts of projects like that. And I don't think there's been a lot of that kind of empirical contextualized research done so far. So how do we do it? It's a mix of kind of research tools. So obviously we don't rely on quantitative data only. It's much more kind of qualitative data. So I would call it a type of ethnography, media ethnography. And I spent quite... quite a lot of time, actually, both at the Brunswick studio, the recording studio, as well as at SYN, while kind of our kids produce their radio programs. Possibly this is why I can't share with you my findings, is because I immersed myself so much. So I, you know, turned into a little bit of kind of native of our kind of youth work side. But it, of course, has incredible returns in terms of, you know, the richness of data. It's not only interviews, and from my perspective, I think very often media researchers overestimate interviews as a kind of research tool. I think it's important to combine it with sort of, again, very contextualized data that comes from, for example, the referring agencies that refer those kids to us, like what is their kind of socioeconomic background, etc. But also just being around, like participating in the activities and then following up with conversations. But it's heavily observant kind of based research, I would say. It's also a textual analysis in a way, because I do look at the stories that they produce, like, you know, both those analogs as well as stories that they produce on air. And it's really interesting. The youth work project, whatever its final kind of outcome is, it's been already, from my perspective, quite successful in the fact that it's the Youth Works project has become such a kind of central part of those kids' life. Not only do they come over and sort of produce whatever they are into, like whether it's music or sort of monologues at the Brunswick studio, but they also very often talk about it on the radio itself. So there's quite a kind of convergence and sort of even multi-platform storytelling across different sort of outlets that we provide them with, which is significant in itself. So what else about boring research methods? I think it's also challenging in terms of diversity of kids that we deal with. There are kids that are more regular than others. There's some kids that just pass through the site, so they come in for one-off session and then they disappear. So, of course, my task of tracking those sort of outcomes is much more difficult than it is when I deal with kids who spend, say, 4 months at the site as long as I have. It's a different type of trust, it's a different type of rapport, and obviously it's much easier to capture. What else? I think I want to just end up with the anecdote. So for those who were at our site yesterday, I ended up staying longer and chatting to one of the kids at our site. And we didn't have time to kind of show his monologue, but I can't overstate the importance of the kind of change on their lives if we kind of provide the final evaluation of the project. So, for example, the kid that I talked to yesterday, he was living on the street when he was 10. He was out of sort of formal education for 2 or 3 years. He was telling me yesterday he hardly left the house. He kept, you know, playing computer games. There was no engagement with family, no kind of friends, really. He started at a sort of social work site in Footscray, which is another suburb in Melbourne. Someone told him about BYS, the Brunswick sort of youth services, our kind of partners now. So he basically got quite informally referred to BYS. He was telling me yesterday it's really important for him to thank this person who referred him across the suburbs, because he found himself quite by accident in the context that he suddenly has got some, even if in temporary, aim in his life. He is now enrolling for the certified courses that we will be running next year. He's quite kind of critical, or, you know, sort of careful about making big future sort of projections at the moment. But as it is now, suddenly his kind of life story expanded beyond, you know, very short-term kind of computer game engagement. And for the research, I think it's really important to capture both quantitative and qualitative stories that sort of feed into the project that are about social change. And I'm really happy to be working with a set of people who bring this very diverse expertise to it, and therefore hopefully we are able to produce more contextualized and kind of comprehensive account of the project. Thank you. So any question, guys? To any of us.
Turnover within those, in real terms, that means probably about 75% of people are now new. Some carry over into a couple in a row. But it's really interesting, and we're thinking really hard about our in-house training for next year. How to offset if you make it short and cheap and chuck them in the studio, or make it more comprehensive and sort of keep them a bit longer.
Marcus?
From visiting the space yesterday, and also from the way you described your work, it kind of occurs to me that you're really achieved to create a space that seems to be nurturing and kind of bringing out young people's creativity. And I wanted to ask you about these young people's motivation for coming to the space and joining in, because it seems to me that it's not really this kind of, you know, conventional approach of a professional development exercise where you're kind of dragging people in by their ears and kind of say, well, you will have the kind of the carrot in front of their nose might be employment opportunities.
That's right.
Actually, you need to have these kind of strategies. It seems to me, I'm not sure if that's right, that these people are motivated by other factors, and I'm wondering if this kind of theme that seems to be emerging around giving young people a voice is playing into this, and I wanted to ask you about the kind of factors that motivate people intrinsically to actually go there without being paid or having, you know, the kind of golden carrot in front of them, but also how this sits with having a voice and then being heard, because I'm wondering if young people actually need to have the feeling that whatever creative expression they come up with, is it just that the actual process and the end result in itself is already good enough for them to continue participating and keep on going? Or do they need to have the feeling that on the radio show, for example, there's actually someone listening that gives them feedback?
Well,
is that going to be a large audience, or is that quite happening?
Well, this kind of, like, I just answered this point very briefly and then I sort of pass on to Craig. There's a set of motivations. Like, for example, the kid that I talked to yesterday, like, he's not that thrilled about being on radio itself. So this whole kind of, again, rhetorics of kind of having real audience, as much as I, you know, said I value this partnership because it does have real audiences. For this particular kid, it wasn't an issue at all. He's like, I don't care. I don't care about radio that much. For others, you know, the quotation that John used, like, it actually does matter to be on the radio. It actually make a difference for them to be able to upload stuff on YouTube and be on radio. It's a different platform. So all I'm saying is there's different set of motivations, and you can't just have one sort of blanket approach in terms of the kind of media creation motivation. And
motivations connect with each other in a looping fashion. Brunswick Youth Service, our underlying rhetoric would be belonging community. It's safe belonging for kids that haven't been safe, and it's a place to belong. And from that platform of relative security, kids at this developmental stage of their life can actually grow. They've got somewhere to stand and from there grow. Now, within that, one of the looping things is voice. If we don't have a voice, we lose ourselves as individuals. There's something about voice that constitutes us as individuals. And certainly it's even more evident, I think, that the voice connects us in community. So we come back to that community theme. And without voice, we've got no way of belonging safely with others.
Sure. Well, basically what I'm trying to ask is, if, say, there is, you know, the product of the creative expression, it might be a video, and the video is uploaded onto YouTube, or the creative expression might be a radio show and it's broadcast. If there is an audience of zero, does that actually matter, or do they actually want that type of feedback?
The answer is yes and no. It depends on what you're aiming for. I think for a young person to be able to say, that's me, whether people are listening or not, that's really important.
I think the one thing I've got, and this goes across all our school programs to do it soon, is that they know they've got to do the show. There's a time, there's a deadline, they've got to be there and actually do it, and that the impetus is not always to the audience, but it might be to Sin, or it might be to John or Netta, who they've said they're going to go there and they're going to do it. That's sort of the step one. You'll be able to comment more on that, but with groups like Youth Voice that we've worked with, the kids, well, I've got to be there at a certain time, and if it's the immediate thing, I've got to do that then. It's different to uploading to web, so I think it's a different set of parameters there.
But philosophically, your question is also, does the text exist if there's no reader or hearer?
Is there a point of writing the text if there's no reader?
And our answer is, for many of our kids, yes.
Emphatically, yes. Yeah,
but I guess it's really differs across the board. For some, it is quite, you know, rewarding to be, you know, sitting in a room and paint a painting, basically, or kind of make a monologue. And it doesn't matter that no one, not there's not going to be a huge audience. For others, actually, it does matter that they can produce CDs and start, you know.
He's a performer. Like, you meet this kid and he's a performer, isn't he? Like,
it's true, yeah.
He has different personalities as well, you know, some people want to.
So in a way, they started even performing the music on the radio because they can. And they started uploading it on YouTube as well. So there is this kind of much more complex, even sort of now delivery platform. And there's different motivations. I don't think we should really, we should start like avoiding pinning it down to kind of one set of reasons or motivations. Is there anything you want to add?
No, I think that's great.
Mm-hmm. And yourself with some true ethnographic research. I just wondered if you could tell me a little bit more about what, you know, how you went about sort of, you know, making the transition from just sort of observer researcher doing some interviews to kind of embedding an immersive.
Yeah, that was a huge learning curve because I spent, you know, I spent quite a few years being a researcher, you know, locked up in my office at university. But I've been always sort of attracted to this idea of being kind of close and quite faithful to people, just kind of people-minded. I do feel that academia needs more sort of empirical research and more kind of people-oriented studies. And I claim that I'm quite a social person, so it hasn't come with big difficulty. But in terms of course, of methodology, it's much more, it takes much longer. It's such a kind of time-extensive process. And I think I pretty much forgot to mention it, that for this type of evaluation, it's required an extended period of time to even conduct this research. And we've got resources to do it. So obviously, me being at the site for 2 or 3 days a week, this is a huge kind of, you know, commitment on the part of researcher. So do you want to, like, say what happened on the first day when I joined the project?
The first day we had two workshops set up, one with a very pretty hardcore group of kids, I've got to say, who were in pretty oppositional kind of mode, who came in and of course, Anita came on board really looking forward to working with the young people who are at risk. This is fantastic. Salvation, all that stuff I talked about. And, of course, you get in the space and they're going crazy. They're saying, fuck off or whatever. And you're faced with a whole set of creating relationships and building that from the ground up. And you have to build a culture. So by the end of the day, she was exhausted, I've got to say. And we also followed that up with a workshop from a rapper by a guy called Joel Marr from TZU. And with a group of kids we'd worked with, and then she got to see how kids we'd worked with over a period of time were so engaged and on board and on side. So a contrast between kids who'd come in, just walked in the door, we had to start building a culture very quickly with them, kids who'd been part of the furniture for a while and the culture was there and they're working alongside us.
Well, I did make comments to John that sometimes I do understand why I spend so much time at university, being in my office.
Go back to the office.
So there is this kind of messiness of doing this type of research that sometimes is quite confronting, but I think unless we do it, we know what's really happening.
We're time-wise, there's probably another session about to start here, is that right? Have we got another session? I'm not sure. Is there any other questions then before we finish?
On that research question, the research methodology, it's challenging the assumption of objectivity too.
Yeah.
And when you're researching people, let's take a look at that. We can't be objective.
Hmm. Yeah, like I think the position of the researcher is critical here.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, folks. Thank you.